Good morning, everybody. This is John Hoskins. I'm the co-founder of Advantage Performance Group, and I'm here to moderate our meeting this morning with Martin Lewis of Market Partners. And we're going to start here in just a few minutes as the last couple of folks get online, and we will kick off and get started. Well, good morning. I've got 9:02. This is John Hoskins. I'm the co-founder of Advantage Performance Group, and we have a nice audience of folks from a cross-section of industry segments here on Friday the 13th, and we're delighted to again welcome Martin Lewis from Market Partners to present to us a relatively new concept that Martin has developed called third-generation selling. And for those of you who have not heard Martin present before, he is an outstanding subject matter expert in the field of sales performance and has quite a pedigree in terms of not only being a consultant in the industry, but actually being a line manager responsible for a large sales organization. And so he comes to us with having done the work as well as consulting to people about the work. Now, what you have in front of you is a map of the Market Partners footprint. They today have over 100 client organizations that they've worked with, 30,000 plus sales professionals, and have completed projects in 37 countries. Martin lives in the Northern California area, is a pilot in addition to being a consultant, and welcome, Martin.
Well, thank you, John, and good morning to everybody. It's my pleasure to be with you here again, talking about one of my favorite topics, and that's sales and selling. So this morning, I want to kind of start off by saying that in my opinion, we have what I would say is a selling crisis, that people are working harder and harder. We're seeing that sales cycles are getting longer and longer. To generate leads, it's getting more and more difficult. And then you need so many more leads to generate a customer. In fact, a recent survey said that salespeople are now working 17% harder to get the same result as they got just 3 years ago. That's almost a day a week. So it seems that people are working harder to get the same result. What's at play? Well, obviously, we're facing a tough economic time. But is there more at play? We actually think that there certainly is. So to understand what's happening and what's behind the selling crisis, let me take you on a journey. Let's start with what I like to call is rule number one. What's the key to success in sales? Well, I think that if you're selling hard, one of the key ingredients is to actually have somebody who's buying hard involved in that process with you. It's kind of interesting, as John said, I've got many years as a sales manager, and I've worked with a lot of salespeople, and yes, I've even been guilty of this myself, selling hard when there isn't a customer that's buying hard, a customer who may just be interested in what we're offering, but isn't really committed to a buying process. So I like to call this rule number one, that when we're committed to a buying process, it's really a key to success to be involved with somebody who's actually buying. So what does buying look like? Let's kind of look at buying through the ages to see what's happened. And let's go back to the early days of selling and kind of fun that maybe one wanted a stone wheel or something like this. And buying was fairly simple. The communication between ourselves as buyers and those who were selling was really face-to-face. We'd walk from our cave down the road to whoever was selling the stone wheel. Our choices were few. It was really the people we knew, the people we could reach, the people we could talk to. And really, the process of buying was fairly simple. If we needed something, we'd go to the person that was selling it and buy it. So that was really the kind of the way that selling and buying existed for many, many years. The selling was really fairly simple. We were selling a product, like the wheel or whatever it may have been, and success was really on our selling skills. So over the years, maybe I'm advancing a little bit more from the Stone Age here, but over the years, the focus became how well do we sell in terms of how well do we present our product? Can we relate its benefits to our customers? Can we negotiate? Can we handle objections? So that was really the key to success. That brings us forward now to around about the 1940s, and things started to change. And for those of you that don't know what that is actually a comptometer from the National Cash Registers Machine. NCR and IBM are essentially credited with starting to look at sales differently and create what is known today as a selling methodology or a sales process. What changed? A number of things changed. How we bought was changing. Communication now wasn't face-to-face. Communication was by telephone. We could reach out and talk to many more people. Our choices, we started to get more choice of the people we could buy from as we started to communicate with more people. And the process of buying became, as it says here, multi-transactional. We would not just talk to the salesperson once. We may have a series of conversations with a salesperson over maybe weeks or months to establish a relationship and then buy. The keys to selling here were we were focusing on the solution the customer wanted. And really, as I said, IBM and NCR were the people who started creating what we know today as a sales process, linking together a number of selling steps to start understanding a customer, qualify them, present a solution, and then negotiate and close. So life again was good. Selling continued for, I would say, about 40 to 50 years in this mode. But then change arrived again, massive change. We see a world that is now technologically connected. It's globally shrinking and economically recessing. Has this changed the way that people buy? I really believe it has. Has this had an impact on the way we sell? I think unprecedentedly, yes. We see people buying totally differently today, and it's impacted sales, I believe, like never before. Some of the things we see today is that our customers, when they buy, are far more empowered. It's only a click of a mouse, and we can find out information we needed. No longer do we have to ask companies to send us brochures. No longer do we have to phone 1-800 numbers to get product information or pricing. Everything's available to us at the click of a mouse. When people are buying, they don't rely on salespeople anymore to communicate to them their products, their company's offerings. Social networks now allow us to tie into other customers of that company without that company even being involved. So buyers have become much more empowered. The second of the three things that I think have totally changed the way people buy, we're now seeing organizations that are much more networked. The notion of a single decision maker, I think, is a thing of the past. When we're working with our clients, we often talk to their customers about how they're buying. And when we ask people, who made the decision to go with company A or product B? Often they go, wow, that's a great question. We don't know. It was kind of a dynamic decision where many people across the organization influenced and brought to the table different things that changed how we made a decision. There's no single decision maker. Decisions to buy now are made in a much more dynamic and networked fashion. And finally, and this couldn't be truer in today's economic climate, what we call fully deployed resources. That companies don't have the time, they don't have the money, they don't have the resource, and often don't even have the energy to explore new ideas with salespeople. We worked for a company in Arizona that it doesn't really matter what their product was, but that the service they were offering to hospitals was really compelling. There's no doubt when we started working with them that if a hospital subscribed to their service, the hospital would save money and reduce toxic waste. So I was working with the CFO of that company. I remember so clearly he said to me, only a fool would not buy from us. We save the hospital's money and we reduce toxic waste. I looked at their value proposition, extremely compelling. It really was that case. So why had they stalled? Why was their growth slowing down? So we went to hospitals and we said, what do you think of this service? The surprising thing was maybe the hospitals came back and said, yes, we believe if we bought from this company, we will save money and we will reduce toxic waste. So that brings us to the question of why, therefore, weren't they buying? The answer is very simple. They told us. They said, you know, but that's only one of a whole list of things that we're looking at. It's not that we don't have any other choices. We've already invested in these other areas that are going to reduce us money or increase patient safety. Yes, we will get round to this one day, but today we don't have the time, we don't have the money, we don't have the resources. We've already deployed them into the strategies we've chosen. So companies have fully deployed their resources. What does this mean? It means that we've had a dramatic shift in the power between the buyer and the seller. The buyer today has far more information, far more choice, less resources, and less time. What does this mean? It means that the salesperson, the seller, has less control. The buyer is no longer coming to the salesperson to ask for information. The seller has less access, less power, and more competition. So this means that dramatically the power has shifted from the salesperson to the buying person, that really the buyer, the customer, is now in control. So does that mean that we've reduced sales to just a spectator sport? Does that mean there's no place now for a salesperson? Has technology taken over from the role of the salesperson? My answer is dramatically no, that is not the case. Now, a big qualifier here, if the salesperson was just delivering product information, if the salesperson was doing no more than being a walking, talking brochure, delivering information, delivering presentations, generic presentations about the company and its products, I'm afraid that that has very little value add. However, if the salesperson was differentiating the company in the mind of the customer, I think there is a huge role for sales. In fact, as a salesperson, I've never been more excited because I believe more and more differentiation is occurring in the sales process by the salesperson than by the product that we're selling. Let's have a look at that a little bit more. But this really leads me to what we're now calling a third generation of selling. A third generation of selling that matches today's buyers. What are we seeing? Communication now is the internet. It's ubiquitous. The choice that customers have is almost unlimited. The process that they go through when they're buying is multidimensional. There's many people involved, and it's much more fluid and dynamic. So selling, and what we mean by a third generation of selling, selling has to shift. Now, a very important point here is that I believe this is building. The first generation of selling, when we were focusing on sales skills, is still a requisite to be successful today. The second generation of what we call selling, when we focus on the sales process, is still required today. But we've got to step up to the third generation of selling, where we're really focusing on the buying process. The focus shifts from the selling process to the buying process. And what we have to do is synchronize all of our selling activity with the buying process. And this is what we mean by third generation selling.
So Martin, this is John. If we accept this premise of third generation selling, and you're out in the market all the time, and I know working with some of the world's leading organizations in many industry segments, where do you think a lot of customers are in the transformation from second generation to sort of third generation?
I think that's a really interesting question, and I'll answer it by revealing a little bit more of my background. I've spent most of my time selling in the high technology world, and I thought, with a certain arrogance, I guess, that high technology sales was really where it was at. Since exploring other industries over the last decade, I actually found the reverse to be true. I actually found the organizations that have embraced this new way of selling are actually the organizations that have got what one could consider the more pedestrian and commodity-type products, because
really?
They have, for some time, had to sell against a competition that's offering the very same kind of product as they sell. And the key to their success and what they found is understanding the customer and, indeed, adopting this third-generation type of selling approach to differentiate themselves from their competition.
So really, because of the nature of their product or service being almost commodity-like, they were forced to look for other ways to differentiate themselves.
That's exactly right. And really, you have a few options if you're in that situation, and you can pick particularly any kind of market, and you can see it. You can either just drop the price and compete on price, and that's a strategy. That is a strategy that can be successful if that's one you opt for. Or you can just simply try and work harder, have your salespeople out there working harder than anybody else's. Or you can step up to this third generation of selling. And as we look at various marketplaces, we often find the market leaders, the companies that are most profitable, have absolutely done that through their selling process.
Now, I know you've got some simple suggestions for steps that people can take to do this. Why don't you show us those?
Well, exactly. So I think for the rest of the time we're going to spend together, I'm really going to talk about, so if you accept this notion, how do you get there? How do you step up to a third generation of selling? I think there's three steps. And for each of those three steps, there's actually three sub-steps. And I'm going to go through those with you, offer you some kind of thoughts on how you can do this, why you would want to do it, and perhaps some tools or some different ways of looking at things that I hope would be useful. So
Great. To
us, the three steps are start with understanding the customer's buying process, then craft an organizational selling strategy, and that in itself is such an interesting topic. When we work with organizations, we often ask, what is your sales strategy? And many organizations, when we use that term selling strategy or sales strategy, are thinking about a particular account or a particular opportunity. What we mean by a selling strategy, an organizational selling strategy, is how, as an organization, are you going to engage in your marketplace? So rather than leave it to the mercy of all the salespeople going out there and trying to do something good in the marketplace, working harder and harder, we should optimize and have a corporate approach to selling. We'll take a look at that in a few moments. And then finally, step three is when we synchronize our selling to buying and enjoy the benefits of having stepped up to third generation selling.
So hey, Martin, John, does this apply both to B2B selling as well as B2C in your opinion?
Yes, it does. One big qualifier there, where it is a very simple transaction, where in either the B2B or B2C world, the selling occurs in just one transaction with the buyer, I don't believe this has so much power. This has power when it's multi-transactional. It's what we could say a more complex sale.
Okay.
So the first thing is to kind of gaze out into our marketplace and look at what may appear to be a maze to map the customer's buying process. Now, here's the good news about customers' buying processes. Buying, we have discovered, is not a random activity. It's a very complex activity, but it's not a random activity. We argue that in any particular market, customers buy in a very similar approach, a similar way, a similar process. In fact, if we discover in a market that customers are buying in different ways, we then argue that isn't one market. That's actually more than one market. So the first thing we do is map the customer's buying process. Here, I show a very simple, generic, eight-step buying process, starting with, and this is, as I said, very generic, starting with steady state, and then moving into, I recognize that there's an opportunity or a challenge that I as a company or I as a person want to solve. I may then assess what my options are. I define what I'm going to do. I evaluate alternatives. I select the alternative I'm going with. I purchase and acquire. So that's a very generic buying process. But then what do we want to do? We want to then look at who is involved in each of those steps. Who by function or by role in an organization is involved, and what do they value? So an easy one is purchasing. Purchasing or strategic sourcing is usually involved in the last few steps of the buying process. Maybe that's not true in all organizations, but typically that would be true. So we start to say who is involved in which of these steps, and then very importantly, what their value drivers and buying style is. What do they value? Do they just value price? Do they value service, responsiveness? Do they value expertise? And what causes them to move forward? Because in this kind of buying process, the customer can stop, pause, go back. They do go through these series of steps, but at any time, this can stop. So what are the things that cause them to move forward through that buying process? This is the kind of thing we map. I've introduced a term here, buying style. I want to drive down onto this because I think this is one of the most critical things to understand when we're looking at how individuals and organizations buy. want to introduce to you a model that we call a four-quadrant buying model, and it's based on two polarized scales. Firstly, on the horizontal, we see two ways of buying. And I really want to emphasize this is in the mind of the buyer. When somebody, B2C, B2B, when anybody goes to buy something like ourselves, if we're buying something, what's in our mind? We either think we have choice. So as we start our buying process, we believe that any one of a number of suppliers or any one of a number of products will do. We realize that we may end up buying one because it's got a better price or it has more features, but as we engage in our buying process, we believe that we have choice. The other end of the scale is that really only one supplier, only one product can provide what I need. And I will go to that product, that supplier, time and time again over the competition because of something I value that I see as unique. And I can pick all sorts of examples around this. I used to drive BMWs. I bought three BMWs in a row. The second and the third, I didn't look at any other manufacturer. I was, for whatever reason, I believed that BMW was the car I wanted to buy. So I did not shop around. There's many examples we can think of where people will perceive, for some reason, and it may be quite different from person to person, there's a uniqueness that they value about one particular offering over others. This is binary. This is polarized. There's nothing in the middle. Customers either believe they have choice, or they'll go to a particular supplier because of the relationship, because of perceived expertise, or whatever it may be. The second scale, which we'll put vertically, is what we call I know, you know. The first one is, in the mind of the customer thinks, I know what I want. I know the product, I know the service, or maybe I know the products and services I need to buy to satisfy my need. I'm out in the market looking to buy these particular things. On the top, the you know I have a need, but I don't know what I want. I want help. I know that I have to do something, but I need somebody, a salesperson, and a company, to help me with my decision of what I should buy. Once again, this is binary. Either the customer perceives they know exactly what they want, or they know they have a need, and they're looking for help. So interesting enough, that brings us to four quadrants of buying behavior. The first one, on the bottom left, is where we perceive we have choice and we know what we want. This is RFP land. This is where we can just go out, we can rank and stack the various offerings against each other and see who comes in best. We're looking for maybe free discounts, and I actually saw that in an advertisement just a little while ago. I'm not quite sure what free discounts are. But obviously this is enticing people to buy from you over the other choices they may have. The top right quadrant, this is I'm looking for help, and I want to go to this particular company to help me. In the technology world, IBM Global Services is a wonderful example of how they have dominated the overall technology services marketplace, where company after company will go to IBM Global Services to help them because they perceive IBM has global reach, they perceive they have great capability, depth of expertise, maybe they've worked with them before, so they go to IBM Global Services over competition, and basically they're in the you-know mode of buying. Come in, tell me what I should be doing. The other two quadrants are kind of fun because they're not often thought about. The you-know choice, this is where people are looking for help, but they believe they have got choice. An example of this may be, and this is a totally hypothetical example, maybe I've just won a couple of $100,000 on the lottery, and I've never had such money before in my life, so I'm looking for somebody to be a financial advisor. How should I invest this? How can I minimize my tax? So I need a financial advisor. So I'm in the you-know model. I don't know what I should be doing. I'm looking for help. But I perceive that there's any one of a number of financial advisors who could help me. So I just Google, I look to see who's in my immediate area, and then maybe I phone them up to see who's available to meet with me this afternoon. So that's a you-know choice. The fourth quadrant we call the Starbucks quadrant. This is the I know exactly what I want. I want a coffee. It's 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm on my way to work, I need a coffee. But I'm willing to drive past many other places I could buy coffee to go to Starbucks. where I will stand in a long line, go through a very complicated ordering procedure, and pay more for a cup with my name on it. Starbucks is a great example of this. I know what I want, but I will favor one supplier or one product over all others.
So, Martin, let's pause here for a moment. This is a lot of information and really a great model. It strikes me as though I have clients who are in all of these quadrants with various products. Is it possible that an organization could almost be dysfunctional because they have a sales force trying to sell in all four of these ways?
That's so interesting. Let's validate your first comment. Organizations and individuals do buy across all four. Dysfunction will be when we try and sell in all four. So we know maybe that strategic sourcing or purchasing are going to typically try to marginalize us and compete us. So typically, the purchasing role in an organization, buy in the bottom left. Now, if we can't differentiate our product in any other way, we've every right to go to the cheapest supplier. So if we can't differentiate the value that our product or offering brings over our competition, then don't expect to win the business. However, if we can differentiate it, maybe by there are particular points that have great value to an end user, so we can start to move into the right-hand quadrant. Then we've got to have a strategy on, are we going to sell that way or are we going to sell just on price? So one of the most important things here, as we're going to see, is that you have to optimize around one of these quadrants. It is extremely difficult, and there are no examples that we know of best-in-class companies that are able to sell successfully in more than one of these quadrants.
So for our participants this morning, one of the first things they should do is go internal to the VP of sales of each of those functions and say, here's this model, and where do you think we are?
Absolutely. When we do this in a workshop format at this point, we often get to the whiteboard and start mapping out customers, where they're buying, how they're buying, and start to get really in terms of what's really going on in the marketplace.
Great.
We'll take a look at that when we talk about sales strategy. But it's
okay.
such a simple yet very powerful model to understand how customers are buying and how we
agree.
Sell. There's some interesting things. We'll just take a quick look about what we call the drivers, what moves people around here. And there's a very important point. People move around here. And as salespeople, we can perhaps move them around. So moving people from right to left, they've got competition, they've got choice, they're focusing on price, that there's maybe a good enough product. And so many of our clients who sell what they may consider to be value-added premium products are now seeing their market erode as customers are going to products that are clearly inferior to their own, but they're good enough. Strategic sourcing, I've already mentioned. These are things that pull people to the left. If I go back to the 80s and I look at the business PC marketplace, companies were buying from IBM, HP, Digital Equipment, because those are the companies that were selling serious business computers. So when they started to buy personal computers, companies would buy from those brand names. Then along came Gateway, Compaq, Dell, and essentially pulled the market to the left and said, you know, you don't have to buy a personal computer from IBM. What's important is the speed, the feed, the capacity, and the price. So it was those companies who essentially dragged how people bought personal computers across to the left of this model. Going the other way, people will buy over other suppliers because of a brand, because they value service. Maybe the provision of a unique value or a relationship will cause people to buy on the right-hand side. When we look at the top, the kind of customers that buy here, they value the expertise or capability that maybe a supplier can bring them. They know that IBM Global Services has far more knowledge than they have in-house, that by engaging IBM Global Services, maybe they're paying more than engaging another consultant, but they'll get that better a solution, that better advice, and that pays off for them in terms of business results. Pulling people the other way, educated customers, where they have in-house expertise. So as customers become more and more educated, we see that they buy in the I know mode. So that's the four quadrant buying model. So that's the first step. Just to recap, step one is really mapping the customer's buying process, understanding who from the customer by function or role plays at each of those steps, and then what are the value drivers that cause them to move forward, what do they value, and how are they buying in terms of their style, in terms of those four quadrants. With that as the basis, we can now craft our organizational selling strategy. We now understand how our customers buy, we now understand how we can influence how they buy, and we can start to ask ourselves a series of questions, and we can craft an organizational selling strategy that starts to focus our selling efforts rather than empowering every salesperson to go out and explore the marketplace and see what works and what doesn't work. So the first thing is the market focus. Which of those four quadrants should we try and dominate, and how? Do we really have a value proposition that customers will truly value and find unique? If we don't, we're going to be on the left-hand side. Can we provide an expertise or a capability that customers are really searching for? Not that we think is neat, but customers think is neat. That would cause us to go to the top of the four quadrants. Having selected the quadrant we want to play in, then how can we move customers to that quadrant? I gave the example of how Dell, Compaq, Gateway, people, they moved the market from the right to the left and sold on price, features, performance, and functionality. So how can we move customers? How can we move customers to really value our expertise and move them to up the four quadrants? So how can we try and move markets and move customers through marketing and selling efforts to the quadrant we wish to sell in? And then what do we do with all the business that may come our way in other quadrants? So if we decide we're IBM Global Services, if we decide that we're going to sell in that top right, we're going to be a trusted advisor, we're going to invest in deep expertise to bring to customers, we're going to have value-add relationships, what happens when an RFP lands on our desk from a company we've never heard of before, and they're looking for some consulting advice, and they're competing us against six other companies? What do we do? Do we compete on price? Do we try and take them back in their buying process to value the expertise we can bring? What do we do? So the first question we ask is, what's our market focus? Then where do we engage in the buying process? Is our strategy to engage right at the front end? Is our strategy to really go in when a customer hasn't considered our offering before and move them from step one, steady state, to step two of recognizing a need? Is that our strategy? Or is our strategy to wait until they're going to buy something and be ubiquitous and show them that we can provide that to them faster, cheaper, better than anybody else? So we don't engage till very late in the buying process. So the second question is, where in the buying process are we going to engage? I don't need to go through all the implications of that, but let me assure you, they are huge. If we choose to engage early in the buying process, we have an expensive and long selling cycle. But there could be huge benefits to that at the back end, where we can dominate and essentially have no competition. And then finally, having now understood how we can engage in the buying process, how are we going to influence the buying process? What are we going to do to influence the buying process? And that's very interesting, because there's really only four things we can do. This is when we start to get extremely focused and on target. These are the only four things that we can do to influence the buying process and ultimately to influence our results. It's to gain new opportunities. How can we gain more opportunities for us to engage in? How can we then increase the probability that the customer will select us over all other alternatives? Over our competition, or over doing nothing? How can we decrease the time it's going to take for the customer to make a commitment? So how can we actually decrease the cycle time that the customer goes through in the buying process? Maybe a strategy there would be to highlight the cost of delay. What does it cost that customer if they delay making that decision? And then the fourth one is increase the size of the spend. Now, it was interesting, just even earlier this week, I was talking to some sales and marketing people, and they were talking about a branding exercise. And they said, well, the branding exercise doesn't really impact the buying process. I argue that everything we do in sales and marketing should be aimed at one or more of these four things. That's it, that's all. If not, how are we why are we doing it, and how are we going to increase results? So those are the four things that we can do to influence the buying process.
Martin, when you say increase the size of the spend, are you suggesting the addition of value-added services around a product that would increase the total value or dollar value of what the buyer's purchasing?
Absolutely. So we can cross-sell, upsell, maybe differentiate ourselves by showing how some of our value-added services are going to enhance their overall return on investment from investing in a product, for instance. Working with Autodesk recently, very definitely they've seen how by offering educational services, people who invest in their software can get more of return from using that software. Their software is highly functional. They've got so much functionality, it's incredible these days. But unless the engineers and architects have got education and training on how to really use that functionality, it's worthless. So what they've been able to do is by selling education and training to their customers, they're increasing the size of the spend, and in fact, they're differentiating themselves as well. One has to be careful here, though, because once again, we don't want to believe our own press. If we're just building up a particular offering by adding upselling and cross-selling various services, and yet the customer sees those as having little value, all we're doing is increasing the price. This is a overall selling strategy that we're crafting here. What should we be doing? What can we do? So with those two steps complete, having mapped the customer's buying process and determined our organizational selling strategy, we can now really implement third-generation selling, where we start to synchronize the selling with the buying. So the first thing is our sales process. The thing to realize here is it's the buying process which is dominant. I think maybe it's arrogant, maybe it's just old thinking. To actually think that the sales process controls the buying process today, I think is crazy for all the reasons we've talked about in the last 30 minutes. That the buying process is dominant. The selling process has to reflect the buying process, but then look at how can we influence the customer in each of their buying steps. So the sales process has to be crafted to reflect the buying process, understand where the customer is in their buying process, and then look at how we can influence the customer, how we can bring value in one of those ways to impact the result that's going to be favorable for both the customer and ourselves. So there it is. Here are the things again. All we can do is, as we're going through the steps of the buying process, how can we increase the probability that we'll be selected? How can we decrease the time that it'll take for the buyer to go through their process? And how can we increase the size of the investment? And one or more of those things is what the sales process must do. And I think the real key is how we do that is different at the various steps of the buying process. We could just think about our own businesses for a moment and think about what would we do to influence those three things early in the buying process versus late in the buying process. Late in the buying process, when the RFP comes out, or they're just looking for price, there's few things we can do to influence it. Early in the buying process, there's far more things. But this comes back to what's our overall selling strategy for the organization? Where are we going to engage? How are we going to increase the probability of being selected, decrease the time, or increase the size of spend?
So, Martin, you started out by saying that, and I think many of us on the phone, unless we're in some very special industry segment, would say there's fewer opportunities out there today for salespeople than ever before, and we're seeing still opportunities come our way. How does this help you qualify whether it's a real opportunity or not, and is it something you should invest your time in? I think that in these tough times, the salesperson is apt to almost go after any piece of business, and how does this help you sort out those that are worth going after?
That's so true, and that's one of the real functions behind working harder, that we're selling so hard against customers who aren't buying or customers that are poorly qualified. We see that the very first thing we have to ask ourselves is where is the customer in their buying process? So taking this slide as an example, what step are they in? And then what is our overall strategy? If our strategy is to engage with them early, understand their business, provide them with a solution, if that's our strategy, then where are they in that buying process? and what's happened. If the RFP has just come out and they've been working with somebody else, then they may be at step 5 of their buying process. That doesn't mean we're at step 1 of our selling process. That means we're at step 5 of the buying process, and we haven't been involved in steps 1, 2, 3, and 4. So it really helps qualify where we are and what we should be doing.
And do you play to your strength there if you're saying, well, we only really ever get big deals where we're involved from the beginning? Might you even say, I'm not going to go after that?
Absolutely. And that goes back to the selling strategy. If that's a selling strategy, that then is business that we may decide to walk away from. Or we may try, as IBM does with signature selling, their selling process, take the customer back. So if the first thing we hear about a particular opportunity is at the RFP stage, let's say step 5 of the buying process, the strategy is to go back to the customer and say, we'd love to be involved, but we think that you should be considering these other aspects. And the strategy there is to actually take the customer back, make them question, have they got the right, do they really know the information they need, and introduce new ideas to them about value we could add. And then if we're not successful in being able to do that, qualify the opportunity out.
Gotcha. Thanks.
And this really comes back to that selling, organizational selling strategy. Having done this, we can then manage the total pipeline, because, of course, it's not just one opportunity that the salesperson is managing. It's many. And what we have to do is design our overall sales pipeline. What opportunities do we need? What does an optimal sales pipeline look like? Again, coming off the overall corporate sales strategy, where are we engaging in the buying process? What should our pipeline look like to be successful in the short and the long term? And that's the kind of point two on this slide, is balancing our investment across the total pipeline. We surely need opportunities that are going to make this month's, this quarter's, this week's revenue targets, but we also need to be investing in the future. So we've got to look at what should the overall sales pipeline look like, and then how do we maintain a balanced pipeline of short and long-term opportunities. How do we invest? What selling activities should we be doing? How can marketing support those activities? These are the kind of questions we should be asking ourselves. So that really is what we see as stepping up to third-generation selling, to really understand and map the buying process, to craft the selling strategy, and then to synchronize selling to buying. As we move to a third generation of selling, we've got to let some things go. These are the old myths of the past, which I offer as things that I think we should let go. The first one we've already talked about, you can't differentiate in a commodity world. I'm a very, very big believer that we can, that there's very, very little that should be considered as a commodity. We truly can differentiate. But often the differentiation is being done in the sales process, not by adding features or functionality to the product. We work with...
And Mark,
John.
Do you have an example of a client that you feel in the commodity space has done third-generation selling?
Absolutely. I think one of the most successful organizations we've worked with is a stationery supplies company out in the eastern part of the U.S. They are selling essentially stationery and supplies envelopes. What could be more pedestrian and commodity than that? And yet what they've been able to do is design a sales process so that their sales force is equipped with the tools, the skills, and the abilities to engage in the buying process in a totally different way, to look at how their customers are using the envelopes and to be able to bring them customized envelopes that will meet their true business needs, which is totally fascinating to me when they're competing against so many other people who are just offering envelopes at a particular price, and that's it, that they are actually looking at how their customers are using those envelopes and how they can get business results by using envelopes differently. For instance, things like putting a little window in the envelope so people can see through and are more likely to open the envelope, the way the contents are folded and put into the envelope. Maybe if they've got an offer, the offer comes out first. So by using their expertise of envelopes, they're actually totally influencing the buying process and moving it in the four quadrants. They're truly able to move from bottom left to top right. and their customers come back to them again and again and again.
Great example.
Calling high is the key to success. I'd never want to go down in history as saying calling high isn't important, but it no longer comes down to calling high and trying to find the mythical decision maker. Decisions are made across the organization and often very significantly influenced by people at a very low level in an organization. Managing a sales opportunity, I love this. You can't manage a sales opportunity because the sales opportunity doesn't really exist. It's the customer who's buying something that exists. This goes back to the linkage between selling and buying. What we have to manage is the buying process, not the selling process. Shortening the sales cycle, I love it when people say we need to shorten our sales cycle, especially when I ask them, well, how long is it and how long should it be? And you often get blank stares. We can't shorten the sales cycle. What we can do and what we must focus on is shortening the buying cycle, a very different kind of mindset. I've already talked about that company who had a terrific return on investment value proposition for hospitals. We'll save you money and reduce toxic waste. However, hospitals were not signing up. So a great value proposition, a terrific return on investment, does not just in itself gain commitment. A single decision maker. We talked about decisions are made in a much more dynamic way today. Forecast probabilities. Love this one. The days, I hope, of trying to classify sales opportunities by percentages, saying these are my 90%ers, these are my 50%ers, that really leads to just a lot of frustration and a lack of success. Opportunities must be classified by where they are in the buying process. That is this an opportunity that's at step 7 in the buying process? And then what will it take for that customer to move from step 7 to step 8 and make a commitment? A much more objective way of looking at sales opportunities than just saying, these are my 70%ers, these are my 90%ers, which at best is subjective. Finding the latent pain, an old adage in sales, let's go out, make cold calls, and find the latent pain in organizations and showing how we can help them. Well, most organizations kind of know their latent pain. Maybe we could say there's less and less latent pain. Most organizations are not waiting for a salesperson to come along with a new and enlightening idea of how they can invest money. And even if you could, you're in a line of a lot of people and a lot of investments that are waiting for the company to invest in. So finding the latent pain, again, is really not a key to success. Solution selling, we've already looked at this with the four quadrants. There's no such thing as solution selling. There is, of course, solution buying. Just pausing on that for a moment, going back to those four quadrants, if we're selling in a way the customer isn't buying, it's likely to be frustrating and not successful for both the customer and the seller. So if a customer is buying in that bottom left, they believe they know exactly what they want and they've got choice. We can go in and we can use our best solution selling skills. What we're likely to find is they haven't got time to talk to us. They don't want to give us all the information about their business. They just want a proposal from us and a good price. We have to find customers who are solution buying, or we have to show them why they should consider buying in a solution fashion rather than in a choice and an I know fashion. And finally, selling harder is not the key to success. Selling more intelligently, selling with a greater precision, selling with more focus is the key to success. So those are my kind of 10 favorite myths, the things that we have to let go when we move and step up to third generation selling.
Martin, this is a great slide. Could you just go back to that for a second?
I surely could.
I think you could make a great white paper for all of us to pass around our organizations. This is a really great slide. Sort of these are the resistors, if you will, to making the transformation to third generation selling. And just for participants, we are going to make these slides available to you through your Advantage partner, but I think that's just a wonderful summary of what you've been talking about. That's really well done. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Well, I try and be a little provocative with some of those things, but I could not believe this more strongly, that these are no longer the keys to success. As I said, I would never want to go down in history saying that presenting an ROI and calling high isn't important, but the key is these are no longer the keys to success.
Well, I just don't want to give up forecast probabilities. Is that okay?
No, that's not okay.
Okay.
Well, let me put it this way. If they're working for you, do more. But
enough,
not to go into forecasting, which we can on another time, what we find is in tough times, ironically in good times, forecasts are fairly accurate and nobody really cares. In tough times, forecasts aren't accurate, lots of people care, and more time and attention is put into forecasting. And what we find, and here's the irony, is that it doesn't get more accurate. You just spend more time doing it.
Amen.
Yeah. So, but there are ways, and it's all to do with understanding where each opportunity is in the buying process and how it's going to move forward in the buying process to successful conclusion. And that's what it's about. It's not about hoping and praying that you can bring in a 90%. It's about understanding where the customer is in their buying process. So in summary, that's third generation selling. Again, I use this term stepping up because it's not like what we did in the first and the second generations are no longer important. They are, but we're having to build on that, and the key is now we're having to sell with much more precision, with much more craft, with much more focus, and totally synchronize our selling activity to the buying activity.
Well, this has been fantastic, Martin, and we've met the time commitment. We have time for questions. If you'll open up the line, and for those of you who have questions for Martin, we have a few minutes left and would love to hear your questions. If you're in a situation where you have some background noise, you can mute your line with star 6. So let me just throw out the idea of questions for Martin.
Hi, Martin. This is Chris Sennett from Sun Microsystems.
Good morning.
Hi there. Do you just want to say a little bit more about the solution selling point that you made on the slide before? I thought that was really, really interesting. It's everybody's holy grail, so just interested to hear more about that.
It's all right, and I can actually understand what you're saying.
Well, look at that. I know.
Good to meet somebody I understand here. You know, that's such an important point, and it goes back to that four quadrant, that it's the I know, you know. If the customer believes that they know what they need to buy, and let's face it, with the availability of information today, certain customers are educated. If they understand and think they know what they want to buy, they're not in a solution buying mode. They're out there to look for a product or service that they know they should buy. So you can go in and start talking to them about, well, how's this going to impact your business? And they're going to say, well, that's for me to understand. I just need you to tell me about your products, or I need you to give me a good price. What we have to do is show them how we can bring value or expertise that they lack before we can start solution selling. So that's the trick in my mind. You said the Holy Grail. I see that all the time. Everybody wants to sell in that top right quadrant. They want to be the trusted advisor. I get that. I get why. But I would really caution people because, first of all, it's a very expensive way to sell. It costs about 14 to 16% more to sell that way than other ways. You do get a return. You get some 4 to 5% more return by selling successfully that way. But will the customer truly see you as bringing expertise to their organization? You have to be really honest with yourself and say, do customers see our salespeople as experts with a capability that they don't have? And if the answer to that question is yes, then you can get there. Does that address the question?
That's great. That's perfect. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks.
And that goes back to the organizational selling strategy. And quite frankly, take that one step further quickly. What we've done with many organizations is we've actually helped them divide their market and indeed their sales force into those customers that will value their capability and expertise and buy in a solution way, and those customers who just won't. But there's nothing wrong with that. It's a much cheaper way to sell. If customers know they just want to buy products and you can just sell products, sell them products.
Great. That's super. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Martin, you may well stimulate the economy by all training companies having to change the titles of their programs now from managing sales opportunities to managing buying process, and all the printers will prevail for having changing the mindset.
We can hope, and it all comes back to that shift occurred. And, you know, we think of how technology has impacted salespeople's lives because we've now got cell phones, BlackBerries, laptops. It's wonderful. However, so often we don't realize that it has totally changed the role of salespeople. The way the buyer now engages with salespeople is totally different.
Any other questions? And for those of you who are not asking questions, if you could mute your line with star 6, that would be great.
Yes, Martin, could I ask a question?
Please, yes.
Yes, this is John Collins from Avery Dennison.
John,
one of the things I thought I heard you say is that it's difficult to sell into all quadrants. So if you have a large company whose customers fit into those, whose buying processes fit into those four quadrants, how do you build a strategy around that?
What we do is we actually recommend that you segment the sales force and even the brand, so you develop underneath one organization different brands. So you develop a brand that would be known as, let's say, bottom left, to provide a great product at a great price. And then you may develop a brand that's known as the more the solution type selling, solution type that fits the solution buying mode. So IBM Global Services, look what they did with their PC brand. So what we see is that because you have to optimize the whole organization so differently, plus present a different image to the marketplace, a good strategy is actually to develop different brands and different sales organizations optimized around different quadrants.
So
we
Martin,
the Toyota Lexus model even.
Martin, couldn't you also argue that IBM actually chose to exit a business because it was in the lower left-hand quadrant?
Totally, totally, absolutely. Down in that lower left, it called for, and we could talk a lot more about this, but down in the lower left, it called for marketing, not so much selling, and it obviously very much lower margin. So you can't afford an expensive sales force. Top right, you're absolutely dependent on a very experienced sales force.
Martin, we've got a very bad background noise that some of the participants have said is almost unbearable. So, unfortunately, we're just about at the top of the hour. I think we'll have to cut this off. Why don't we go to your last couple slides, and we'll just talk about our call to action.
I'll put it back onto presentation mode, John.
Yes, good idea.
Whew,
that was good. Martin, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful. So on the slide in front of you, you have the Market Partners web address. One of the call to actions for this webinar is to offer you the opportunity for a roundtable discussion with Martin. And this would be not a sales call per se, but a focused conversation about the applicability of third-generation selling to your business and possible areas of immediate return. And that can be conducted by telephone or face-to-face. And we also wanted to encourage you to work with your Advantage partner if you want to get a copy of these slides, which, Martin, I'd compliment you on the quality of the slides. For a lot of the presentations we've had, they're not up to this standard. So you've set a new standard again.
Thank you.
And also, I wanted to just mention that we're hosting more than a dozen of these sales leadership series this year. If you go to the Advantage website, www.advantageperformance.com, you'll find a listing of all of the hosted webinars for the remainder of the year, and I think you'll find all of them compelling, as we have found your presentation today, Martin. So thank you so much for sharing this with us, and as usual, your presentation style is wonderful. I could listen to you all day, but what's really important is the content is fantastic. It's really helpful. So thank you, Martin.
We're passionate about it. I would really look forward to conversations with anyone exploring these topics further. I really would.
All righty.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks to our participants, too, for joining us. And have a great Friday and a happy Valentine's Day. Take care.